Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 82. I'm recording it on Sunday, January 25th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is How Could So Many Get It So Wrong for So Long? I take strong positions on the passive investing problem. I have learned through experience that making tentative claims, modest claims about the problems of passive investing does not work. So I've learned that I believe the best practice is to state things very clearly and very strongly and very boldly. And so I will say things, probably the strongest statement I've made is I have said, passive investing is not only a bad idea, a bad strategy. I have said that the idea that passive investing could work in the real world is insane. That's about as strong as you can get. Now, I certainly do not say that the people who believe in passive investing are insane. Many very smart people, very good people, very reasonable people believe in passive investing and believe in it very strongly. And I, of course, acknowledge that. But I still do stick with that statement that the idea that passive investing could work in the real world is insane. It's a preposterous idea. Now, my friend Schroeder at the Goon Central Board is appalled by that. Schroeder called me on it, and I think it's a fair question. He was commenting on my correspondence with Michael Kitsis. Michael Kitsis is a financial planner in Maryland, and I've had a lot of email correspondence with Michael that was published at the blog, at the website. And Schroeder said, Rob, why don't you send an email to Michael Kitsis and tell him that you think passive investing, the idea that passive investing can work, is insane. Let's see what Michael thinks of you then. Now, I'm not going to send such an email because I've discussed my views with Michael, and when it comes up, I certainly don't deny such a thing. But Michael knows my views, and Michael knows my opposition to passive investing is very strong. And I don't think he agrees. I think Schroeder is right that Michael does not agree with that. But the great thing about Michael Kitsis is Michael Kitsis is able to disagree with someone without becoming disagreeable. Michael is able to engage in friendly, warm communications, intelligent communications, non-abusive communications, even though he disagrees. And we do agree on many things, and we disagree on some things. And that's the way it should be. I think Michael is a great model for how we all should conduct ourselves in discussions of how investing works. So I don't feel a need to stress that point. If Michael asks me about it, I certainly would explain why I believe that. I certainly would have no problem with that. But I don't feel a need to send him a separate email pointing out that particular belief of mine. But the point that Schroeder is making is that I think what he's saying is your views are so extreme on this question that it puts everything you say into doubt. You know, if you're this far off from what so many smart people say, you know, all these smart people say passive investing is the way to go, passive investing is wonderful, and you say that passive investing is not only an imperfect idea, not only a bad idea, but actually an insane idea, preposterous idea, how can we put any credence in anything else you say? And I think, while most people perhaps are not as direct as Schroeder is about that point, I think that probably a lot of people respond that way when they hear a strong statement along the lines of, you know, passive investing is insane. Passive investing can never work. Passive investing is the worst investing strategy ever concocted by the human mind. Things of this nature. First, I would say, so the purpose of this podcast is to explore that. And the real question being asked is the question in this in the title of this podcast, how could, you know, assuming I'm right, let's just assume for sake of discussion that I'm right, that passive investing really is insane, that passive investing really can never work in the real world. How could it be then? How could it be that so many got it so wrong for so long? That just seems impossible. So I'd like to just talk about that a little bit. I think that is quite indeed the case. I think the reality is millions have gotten it wrong in good intent and all with good intellects, but millions have gotten it wrong, very, very wrong, for a long time. And if we're going to bring about change, if we're going to open up to the exploration of far more effective investing strategies, we have to answer this question. We have to have a good answer to this question of how so many could get it so wrong for so long. First, let me just give a brief description of why I say that passive investing is a preposterous idea. Passive investing is the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to dramatic price increases. I say that that idea is insane. Here's why. The most important thing an investor does is to set his stock allocation. It's the single most important thing that you do, because it's the one thing that the individual investor really has influence over. I can't determine, you know, what the economy is going to do or what stocks are going to do or anything like that. But I can determine my stock allocation. So if I set my stock allocation well, I'm going to do well in my investing plan over the long term. If I set my stock allocation poorly, I'm going to do poorly as a rule. It's the single most important thing you'll ever do as an investor. So you want to get that right. Now, the passive investing idea is you look at various factors in determining your stock allocation. You look at your financial goals, your financial circumstances, your risk tolerance. You look at these things, and then you decide on a stock allocation, and then you stick with it forever. I agree with the first part. I agree that you should look at your financial goals, your financial circumstances, your risk tolerance, and you should set a stock allocation. What I say is insane is the idea that you should stick with a single allocation for all time. So let's just use an example. Say that you look at all these factors and the stock market is priced reasonably as it is today, and you decide on a stock allocation of 60%. And then say that prices go to dramatically higher levels. They go to the levels that existed before the price crash, double the levels of today. Instead of a PE10 level of 14, we're at a PE10 level of 28, double today's levels. So stocks are now priced at double what they were priced at the time you made your stock allocation. Does it make sense to stick at the same stock allocation when prices are double, or is it insane to do so? I say that it's insane. The advocates of passive investing say that's just what you should do. You should stick at the same stock allocation. Now, if I ask the question, Do valuations affect long-term returns? Anywhere I have asked that question, and I've asked it many, many places, I've always gotten the same answer. And this is universal. I've never found one person to disagree with this. The answer I get is, of course, valuations affect long-term returns. That's obvious. Universal agreement. Bill Bernstein, the author of The Four Pillars of Investing, he says that valuations affect long-term returns. And Bill Bernstein is an advocate of passive investing. Bill Bernstein says that valuations affect long-term returns as a matter of mathematical certainty. That's a quote. Mathematical certainty. That's Bill's phrase. You can't get any stronger than that. So there's no question in anyone's mind, even the strongest advocates of passive investing out there all agree, even Schroeder and the others that post at the Goon Central Board, they all agree valuations affect long-term returns. Well, if valuations are double what they were at the time you set your stock allocation, that means the long-term return that you can expect from stocks is dramatically different. If it's double, I mean, that obviously has to have a big effect on long-term returns. Now, when you set your stock allocation, obviously what you're trying to do is you're weighing the risk of stocks versus the reward of stocks. If the return changes dramatically, the risk-reward ratio has changed dramatically. So why in the world would you want to stay at the same stock allocation? That simply makes zero sense. Now, if we go beyond that question, you know, the next question, if we all agreed that passive investing makes zero sense, that we all should be changing our stock allocation in response to big changes in price, then the follow-up question would be, how much should you change your stock allocation? And on that, I don't take nearly so strident a position. On that, I have my own views as to how much you should change your stock allocation. My approach would be to look at the stock return predictor, a calculator at my website that tells you what your 10-year return on the purchase of a broad index fund will be in the event that stocks perform in the future somewhat as they have always performed in the past. I would look at the stock return predictor. I would not make it my only guide, but I would make it a starting point for my decision as to how much to change my stock allocation. But if someone else came along and had some other tool and they said, you know, I'm not going to follow the stock return predictor, I have some other tool, or if someone came along and they said, I don't agree with the premise of the return predictor that stocks are going to perform in the future as they have in the past, I think there's going to be a big change. I think the U.S. is entering a new golden age and stock returns are going to be higher than ever before. Or I think the U.S. has seen its best days and returns are going to be lower than ever before. I would have no problem with that. I might agree with some of the points, but I certainly would not say that such a position is insane or irrational or unreasonable. There are all sorts of different arguments that could be made about how much you should change your stock allocation in response to big price changes. What I say is insane is the idea that you should not change your stock allocation at all. That, I say, and that's passive investing, that, I say, is flat out preposterous. It simply cannot be right. And it's a big deal, because so long as the passive investing school is dominant, and the majority view is that we should not change our stock allocation at all, it's impossible to discuss how much we should change it. This is where all the conflict on the boards has come from. I have argued that we should be starting threads talking about how much we should change our stock allocation, and the discussion has always stopped at that first stage, because the answer from the passive investing advocates is we shouldn't change it at all. There's nothing to discuss about how much. It's not a how much question. It's a should we or should we not question. And I am saying the should we not question is insane. I am saying we should all be discussing how much. And when that change is made, when we recognize that passive investing does not make sense and cannot work, we will open up a flood of wonderful investing insights. Because all the human energy that is now going to avoiding discussion of the realities of stock investing will suddenly be going to discovering what works, which is what we should be doing. You know, we're now devoting millions of man and woman hours to coming up with rationalizations defending passive investing, instead of doing what we should be doing, which is devoting those millions of man and woman hours to learning how to invest effectively, learning how much we should change our stock allocations in response to dramatic price changes. That's the name of the game. The question of how much we should change is really the primary question in stock investing. And once passive investing became dominant, we stopped talking about that question. So we're living in this strange world where the most important investing question of all receives very, very little discussion. Receives no discussion among passive investors. And passive investing dogmatists, at least, often jump in and block discussions that others are trying to have who are not so dogmatic about passive investing. So I think the case that passive investing is insane is clear. I don't really think there's much more to be said about it. No one disputes that valuations affect long-term returns. And if valuations affect long-term returns, the value proposition of stocks obviously is in flux. It's obviously not a constant. And if it's not a constant, it simply makes no logical sense to stick with a single stock allocation when prices change dramatically. And of course, if we weren't sticking with the same stock allocation, we never would have had this price crash. Because if we were not sticking with the same stock allocation, whenever prices got to insanely dangerous levels, the market would self-regulate. When stocks became insanely dangerous, as they did in the mid-1990s, most investors would sell stocks until the price dropped enough that prices would no longer be insanely dangerous, where stocks would again offer a strong long-term value proposition. So all of our troubles that come from price crashes and busted retirements and economic recessions, all of these things would be to a large extent done away with. Obviously, it would still be possible for people to invest ineffectively, but if all of this human energy were going to helping people to learn how to invest instead of rationalizing insane investing strategies, it just seems to me that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing to take all that human energy and turn it from a negative direction into a positive direction. And of course, I'm unable to see why anyone would object to this. You know, Schroeder, the point of his comment is he's objecting to what I'm saying. But obviously Schroeder would benefit from learning about more effective ways to invest. Everyone would. There's not one person on planet Earth who would not benefit. And yet this idea that we should abandon passive investing and move to what I call the rational investing model is, I think would be fair to say, an extremely controversial idea. So I'm always trying to understand why it's controversial, and I think, you know, possibly the biggest reason why it's so controversial is the first thing that the human mind jumps to on consideration of this idea that, you know, maybe passive investing was all a big mistake is, how could so many be so wrong for so long? You know, and the goons will sometimes say this. Schroeder will say, oh, Rob knows everything about investing. Nobody else does, only Rob. There was a guy at, there's an article I have at the site at the Bandit Motley Fool section entitled, it's my favorite article at the site, entitled Investing Discussion Boards Ban Honest Posting on Valuations. And I quote 101 community members. And there's one guy in there who says something to this effect. He says, well, Rob is saying you have to change your allocation, Rob is saying that valuations are a little high, the return's not going to be so great. That's not so far off from what some other people say. So that part I could buy, but Rob is doing more than that. Rob is saying the whole model is wrong. He's making this dramatic statement, and that I just can't buy. So in other words, I'm stating things too strongly for that fellow. I think his name was Jim. And I see his point, but I'm not stating it strongly to antagonize people. I'm stating it strongly because I've learned from experience that stating it weakly doesn't get the job done. If you state it weakly, and it's true that there are people out there who are passive investing advocates who will say valuations affect long-term returns. And that's sort of what Jim is saying that I should say. I should just say, oh, I agree with those people. Like Bogle is an example. Bogle will say, at times of high valuations, he'll say, well, returns might not be quite as good. Be prepared. Be prepared for lower returns. But being prepared for lower returns should logically, the logical follow-up to that is lowering your stock allocation. If returns are going to be low, why would you want to have all your money tied up in stocks? If returns are going to be low, you should lower your stock allocation. And Bogle says not to do that. Bogle advocates passive investing, which is not lowering your stock allocation. So it always comes back to that same question. And so Jim is right. If you take public statements of a lot of the passive investing advocates, they're right in line with what I say in terms of the effect of valuations on long-term returns. But if you get down to the practical level, what do you do? With your stock allocation there, we're totally in conflict. I'm saying you should lower your stock allocation. The passive investing advocates are saying, no, you shouldn't. And so the question is, how could all these people be wrong? And Rob Bennett be right. And it's not only me that says you should change your stock allocation. There obviously are others. Robert Shiller, John Walter Russell. I give this litany all the time. Andrew Smithers, Rob Arnott, Ed Easterling, John Malden, Cliff S. Ness. There are others out there who say, Jeremy Grantham, John Hussman. There are others out there who say you should change your allocation in response to big price changes. But it's not the conventional wisdom of today. The conventional wisdom is passive investing. So how could so many be so wrong for so long? And I guess the first thing I think I should mention is this concept of cognitive dissonance. And I have an entire podcast on cognitive dissonance, and I think it's very important. So I recommend that you listen to that podcast. I think that was called It's Not a Conspiracy, It's Cognitive Dissonance. Not sure, but I think that was something along that line. So was the title. But I gave one example of cognitive dissonance in that podcast, which was compelling to me. It's an answer to this question. And it was there were a couple research students, students who were conducting psychological research, and they joined a cult, and then they reported back on what happened with the cult as their research. And the cult, my understanding from reading this is that this really happened. This was, I picked this up from an internet site. And cognitive dissonance is a well-known phenomenon in the psychological literature. And the idea of this cult was these people somehow came to believe that there were aliens, and the aliens were going to blow up the Earth on a given date. And the aliens would come and take away the members of the cult and save them and then blow up the Earth. And the people in the cult believed this, and they gave up their marriages, they gave up all their money, they gave up their houses, their jobs. They joined this cult, and they prepared for doomsday. And doomsday came. And they're all standing around, you know, I guess 8 o'clock. They're waiting for the world to be destroyed, and nothing happened. And they all start looking at their watches. And the two research students are looking at each other saying, you know, what's going to happen now? It's 8:10. You know, the Earth's still here. What's going to happen? And at 8:10, the leader of the cult says, you know, wait a minute. I have to go contact the head alien. And he contacts them. And he comes back, and the research students are thinking, these people are going to be furious. They're going to stone this guy. You know, they've given up all their money. They've given up their lives, given up their jobs. And it's all just a big hoax. It's all a big joke. But the guy comes back, and he says, great news. You know, the work we did by accepting, you know, what the aliens told us, they've now decided they don't need to blow up the Earth because we believed in them. We have saved planet Earth. And they all were happy. They all were thrilled with what they had done. Now, as I say, when I read this, I'd have to check the website to be certain, but my understanding is that they were just reporting something that happened. There are cults out there that really do believe the Earth's going to come to an end. And when it doesn't happen, the members of the cult don't get angry at the cult leader. They celebrate. Because the cult leader just comes up with a new story. Obviously, anyone could have made up a story that would explain why the Earth wasn't blown up. It wouldn't take a whole lot of effort. A child could do it. So what's going on there? These cult leaders are not necessarily stupid people. I suppose we like to think they are. But many of these, you know, if you look at people who have been in cults, of course, we have an expression for it in our, you know, in our vocabulary today. We say, you know, have you drunk the Kool-Aid because of what happened was it Jonestown? You know, that these cult leader was telling these people drink Kool-Aid laced with poison, and people drank it. And it's hard to believe. But these people weren't stupid people. They held jobs. Why do humans behave this way? Well, first of all, whether we understand why they do it or not, it's just the fact that they do. So we should recognize that. We should not hold ourselves above cult behavior. We all are capable of cult behavior. That's one thing. But secondly, there are reasons why they do it. Now, I like to think I would never run off and join a cult. And actually, I think the explanation for why people join cults is also an explanation for why people don't join cults. It certainly is true that most of us don't join cults. And I can't identify what causes one person to join and another not to join. I'm sure that psychologists have looked at that question, or researchers. But the same basic human tendencies are responsible both for us joining cults and for us not joining them. But what it comes down to is human decisions are made not at the individual level, they're made at the group level to a large extent, not entirely, but to a large extent. And so most of us, the reason we don't join cults is we're out in the work world, or we're in a society, we're in a neighborhood, we're in a family, and the family or the society or the neighborhood is anti-cult. And so if we were contacted by a cult, we would reject them as foreign. But once you're in the cult, the same process applies. At that point, it's the non-cult behavior that is foreign. But the thing that is true in both cases is we act in groups. Social feedback is responsible for much human behavior. Well, you know, apply this in the investing area, and you know, stocks are just designed to take human behavior and cause us to destroy ourselves. Because what happens in stock investing, stocks, stock performance goes in cycles. If you look at the record of stock investing, you'll see that there are years of outstanding, amazing performance from stocks, and people are very reluctant to participate for a long time. And then the social feedback gets to be so strong, all of their friends are participating, that they're enticed and they're drawn in. And then once large numbers of people are drawn in, the cycle changes and we go into a cycle where stocks provide absolutely horrible returns, bone-crushing losses. And then the opposite lesson is learned. In other words, when all our friends are in stocks, we want to be in stocks because we are social animals. And when all our friends hate stocks, we hate stocks. So we're always doing the wrong thing, because when all of our friends love stocks, that's when stocks are overpriced. That's when the long-term return is very poor. And when all of our friends hate stocks, that's when stocks are underpriced and the long-term return is very, very good. So, you know, I think that in itself basically answers the question, how could so many be so wrong for so long? When we think of people like John Bogle and Bill Bernstein and all these others, Jonathan Clements, on and on, we call them experts. And what we think of is they're experts. That means they've studied investing more than we have, and we therefore should place our confidence in them. And that's certainly a plausible idea. But all it really means to say they're experts is that intellectually they understand stocks. They've read lots of books. They've passed tests. That's what we mean. Does it mean that they have a particular ability to avoid group behavior, herd behavior? It doesn't. Because we don't really look for that. That's not really part of what learning about stock investing is about today. It should be. I think that the emotional side of stock investing is 70% of what determines long-term success, but very little is written about it in the literature. Most of what is written about are these intellectual questions. So these people are truly experts on the intellectual questions, but they have no idea what they're doing. And I don't mean that as a dig. They understand the 30% of stock investing, the intellectual side, inside and out. They are true experts. But the 70%, they don't have a clue. And the 70% causes them to engage in herd behavior, in social behavior, in cult behavior. So whenever stock prices go to insanely dangerous levels, there are two things that can happen. One, it could be that most of us would respond rationally. And if that happened, the experts would tell us, look, prices are too high, you need to sell, and prices would self-regulate, and everything would be fine. Stocks would always provide a strong value proposition, something around 6.5% real per year. But the alternative, and every now and then this happens, the alternative is that for some reason, the idea might catch on that it's okay not to change your stock allocation. It's okay to invest passively. And if that were to happen, then prices would not self-regulate. Prices would go higher and higher and higher and higher until they just went to crazy insane levels, and we would cause a massive price crash that would send the economy into a big recession, possibly a depression. But in order for that to happen, you would have to have experts pushing the idea of passive investing. We could never persuade ourselves to buy stocks at the sorts of prices that applied from 1995 through the first part of 2008 without experts encouraging us every step of the way to destroy ourselves. Not intentionally, but we do need their encouragement to behave that way. So the very fact that passive investing has become popular should tell us that passive investing is dangerous, that investing in stocks today is dangerous, or investing in stocks before the price crash was dangerous. Whenever the idea that you don't need to worry about price becomes popular, those are the danger times for owning stocks. And that's, of course, what we've had for the past 30 years, the passive investing era. So what people can't see is, people say, well, passive investing is popular, so it must be right, must be good. But just the opposite is true. Whenever passive investing is popular, that's when stock investing is dangerous. But in order to see that, you have to get outside the circle. So long as you are a passive investor yourself, the idea that there's some danger to it is crazy talk. The cult members, if you were to say to them, why would you give up your job to join this crazy cult? They'd say, what cult are you talking about? We just saved planet Earth, bud. Aren't you paying attention? We're not a cult. Planet Earth was going to be blown up by the aliens, and we saved it. You think there's something wrong with that? If you're in the cult, it's not a cult. In order to appreciate the cult-like behavior, you need to be outside the cult. You need to see it. In order to do that, of course, you need to question it. In order to do that, you need to question the merits of passive investing. And of course, that's just what can't be done. That's why when you question passive investing, when you say the sort of thing that I say, starting off this podcast, that passive investing is insane, you get cult-like reactions. You get extreme emotional reactions. So it's... what I'm trying to do is break that chain. What I'm trying to do is to get people to acknowledge that passive investing is not proven. It's not science. I think we should have respect and affection for people who believe in passive investing because they are smart and they are trying to help us and they're trying to help themselves. But I also think we should question them with the goal of determining, of helping them to determine too, whether this really is cult-like behavior or not. And if it is, we then need to set up guards against becoming cult-like. I believe that the whole investing project is a project of setting up guardrails so that we don't give in to our desire to believe in passive investing. It's all about avoiding the passive investing mindset. If you avoid the passive investing mindset, stock investing becomes a very profitable activity. And not hard to understand. But avoiding the passive investing mindset is a struggle. It's a struggle for humans because we are prone to this sort of behavior. So I just wanted to go through a few indications I've had during the first 7 years of discussions that this is indeed so, that this is indeed what is going on, that passive investing is cult-like behavior. That passive investing is insane emotional behavior. That passive investing is the enemy of the middle class investor. Now, I'll give one example from a thread I participated at just a couple days ago at the Frugal Dad blog. Frugal Dad has a blog. It's a great blog. He's a smart guy and a very hardworking guy, the guy who writes the blog. And he had a blog entry. He doesn't usually write about investing, but he had a blog entry last Monday, saying, have we been told a bunch of lies about investing? And I put up a comment saying, well, I think lies is too strong a word, but we've been given horribly bad advice for 30 years, this whole passive investing era where we've been told we don't have to change our stock allocations in response to price changes. We've been told terrible, terrible advice, but not lies. There's no intent. There's no bad intent. And I don't believe in most cases. It might be in a few cases, but not generally. Now, what's interesting about the Frugal Dad experience is Frugal Dad is a believer in He's a big believer in saving. That's what he usually writes about, money management. And he's a big believer in Joe Dominguez's book, Your Money or Your Life. So I can understand why he has been pained. He's talking in this blog. He's putting forward the idea that he may just take his money out of stocks. And I believe he wants to retire early. He wants to achieve financial freedom early in life. And I think he's pained by the fact that he's been working hard to learn how to manage his money, you know, for years, number of years now. And he's had a great deal of success saving, you know, reducing his spending. But now all of his progress has been lost because he's lost so much money in the market. I don't know what the amount is, but I think he's fairly young, so it's not a big number. But in percentage terms, he's lost a big hunk of saving. And he's saying, you know, why should I work so hard saving if I'm going to lose it all in the market? And he's now thinking the thing to do is not to invest in stocks, it's to invest in treasury bonds, something very safe. And eventually he'll at least get to his goal. Now, the problem with that experience is how do we learn? Let's say there were other areas of human endeavor where we made mistakes, like the mistake we made with passive investing. How would we learn? What would happen is there would come a day when if you're following a bad strategy, you would have bad results. When you had bad results, you would change. You would say, hey, guess I need a new strategy. You know, we do this in politics. If in the recent election, the feeling among many voters was that they weren't happy with the job that the Republicans were doing. And so they kicked the Republicans out. They put the Democrats in. Or if you have a baseball team and you're expecting to run for the pennant, you end up finishing in fourth place, they replace the manager. They say, well, that manager's not doing the job. We need somebody different. If what you're doing doesn't work, you make a change. But see, what happens often in stock investing is, what Frugal Dad is doing is he's saying, okay, what I was doing didn't work, so I'm going to make a change. But the change he's making is not to change the way he invests in stocks. It's to get out of stocks. And that's, you know, it may or may not be the right thing for Frugal Dad, only he can decide, but it's a very bad thing for the rest of us. Because the people who are going to change stock investing, if it's going to change, and I very much want it to change, the people who are going to change it are not the passive investing dogmatists. They are dead set against admitting any mistakes. They are just, you know, they're the cult members. They don't want to change. But Frugal Dad wants to change. He wants to do better. But if he would stick with stocks and say, you know, how can I invest in stocks more effectively? He would learn about these people who dispute the passive investing idea. He would learn about all the research that's been done for 30 years now, showing that valuations affect long-term returns and that you have to change your stock allocation when prices change dramatically. But instead, he's dropping out, or at least he's thinking about it. And there are millions like him. You know, I'm just using him as an example. There are millions doing that. So what happens in stock investing is we go through these cycles where passive investing sounds like a good idea for a few years because the market is behaving irrationally, as it did in the 1990s. And passive investing looks like a winner. And lots of people sign on, becomes hugely popular. Then there's an inevitable price crash. But we don't learn. Because what happens is, instead of learning, we all end up selling our stocks. And then years later, we'll end up getting back in, but we won't get back in again until stocks are dangerous again. And during those years when stocks offer a great value proposition, well, there obviously are some people that will be in stocks and they'll be making fantastic returns, but it won't be most middle-class investors. But the real sad thing here is not the financial loss. The really sad thing is that we don't learn from our mistakes. In order to learn from our mistakes, we have to not abandon stocks. We need to say, the problem isn't with the stocks. You see, what people are saying today is they're saying, stocks are bad. Stocks aren't bad. Stocks are like a hammer. Stocks are a tool. If your house falls down, It's not because the hammer was bad. It's because your plan, your building plan, was bad. It's the guy using the hammer that messed up, not the hammer. We've invested in stocks in crazy, mixed up, upside down ways. That's why we've lost so much of our retirement money. Not because stocks are bad. Stocks are great if you invest in them rationally. But if we keep running away from the problem by selling all our stocks, we're never going to fix the problem. We're never going to learn about our mistakes. So I implore people like Frugal Dad, and I don't mean to single him out. As I say, there are millions. But I implore them, don't give up on stocks because one particular strategy has failed you. The strategy that failed you won't work. You do need to abandon the strategy, but don't abandon stocks. The fault is not with stocks. The fault is with us and with the strategy that we have used to invest in stocks. But see, this abandoning of stocks explains how we've been able to go for so many years without learning the realities of stock investing, because this repeats. We make this horrible mistake and we don't learn from it because we abandon stocks. And so, you know, time goes on and then we make the same mistake again and again and again. We need to get to a point where we say, look, middle class investors need to be in stocks. Stocks offer better returns than treasury bonds. So we need to learn how to invest in stocks effectively. That's the change we need to see. Now, I look for these things. I look for clues about human behavior and, you know, human behavior in regard to investing. Whenever I'm communicating with people, and there's a guy, Felix Salmon. He has a successful blog. He's a smart guy. And he wrote a review of my stock return predictor. And it was a very balanced review. He said very nice things about it. He said this is a nifty little tool. But he was certainly not fawning. He had some skeptical questions as well. So Felix is, I liked his review a lot because it was clearly balanced. He wasn't biased one way or the other. I paid attention to everything that Felix said in his review, and I guess one thing that comes at me is that. He asked me some questions. We had some emails where he asked me some questions before he wrote the review. But something that hit me was, see, I see the stock return predictor as a huge, big deal. This is sort of what Jim was saying. I'm not saying it's some small change. I'm saying it's a dividing line. It's a rejection of passive investing and the launching of a new model for understanding how investing works. Felix, I don't think, saw it that way. He just says it's a nifty tool. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just fine. I'm happy he did it. But I guess what I would say is it explains how we could all be so wrong about investing for so long, because the way the human mind works is when you're exposed to a new idea, we don't tend to think it's revolutionary. We tend to think, oh, just a new idea, just another new idea. And that's how Felix responded. But I don't think it hit him with full force that what I was saying was that if he's going to believe in the stock return predictor, if he's going to believe that returns can be predicted 10 years out, 20 years out, he is really rejecting the passive investing model. He's rejecting the model he uses to invest. I don't think he realizes that. And I'm not at all being critical. What I'm saying is what he's doing is what we all do. But this is partly the explanation for how we could be so wrong for so long. There have been people questioning the efficient market theory and the passive investing model, I think going back to the day this model was first developed. I remember when I was still at my corporate job in the 90s, mid-90s, late 90s, I was doing a lot of research to put together my retire early plan. And I remember I used to go to Borders regularly and look for books on all kinds of things, saving, investing, the economy, just all kinds of subjects. And I remember seeing a book on the bookshelf, The Case Against the Efficient Market Theory. I think that was the title. And I thought, that's an interesting title. And I hadn't, you know, I didn't know all that much about it. I had a rough idea what the efficient market theory was, but it was pretty vague. And I didn't buy the book, but I thought about it. I thought that'd be interesting to read, but I don't know if I have time. And I didn't buy it. But this was in the mid to late 90s. This was a long time ago. So criticism of the efficient market theory isn't something new. But it's astounding to me today to think that what happens is these books come out and they're just sort of, they're ignored. In other words, I don't have a problem if the people who advocate passive investing can punch holes in the argument against the efficient market theory, fine. But they don't. They don't punch holes. They just ignore. There's all this evidence going back to 1980. That valuations really do affect long-term returns, and it's all just ignored. The greatest example of this is when Shiller came out with his book, Irrational Exuberance. Irrational Exuberance was reviewed at all the big publications, Business Week and the Wall Street Journal and Money Magazine and all this sort of thing, and it was widely praised. People say, wonderful book, but they don't seem to get it that Shiller is he's rejecting all of John Bogle's teachings, not all of them, but he's rejecting the passive investing teachings of John Bogle and many others. Well, who's right? Don't we need to figure out who's right? They can't both be right if they're saying opposite things. And if one of them is wrong, we sure, if Bogle and all the other passive investors are wrong, we sure better find out before we lose our retirement money. But see, that wasn't the attitude. The way humans work is when we hear things that cause us discomfort, and finding out that our investing ideas are all built on sand does cause us great discomfort, we don't sit down and grapple with those ideas. That would be the rational thing, to sit down and say, I'm going to figure out who's right here. I'm going to check the data. Is this Shiller guy up to speed, or is he talking out of his, you know? But we don't do that. We put it off. We say, oh, that's interesting. He's a bear. You know, we find some defensive argument. Maybe he's a bear. I don't need to worry about him. He's one of those weirdos. He probably wears glasses, funny clothes. That's how human beings, that's how we can be wrong for so long, because we're not rational as a rule. We don't try to figure out what's right. What we try to do is rationalize what we have decided is right. That happens all the time. Or like Felix. Now, Felix Salmon, he was not rationalizing. He was not saying Rob is wrong, but he was only letting it in a little bit. He was saying, well, that's interesting. We have a tool now to predict returns. I sort of like that. But he didn't draw the conclusion of, wait a minute, is all the passive investing stuff wrong? He let it in a little bit, but he didn't let in the implications. And this is the big issue. This is the big issue. A great example of this, this one just stuns me. Larry Swedrow, he's also a financial planner and author of a number of books, and he posted at the Bogleheads board. And, you know, Larry's respected guy there. And, you know, Mel Lindauer, you know, led this massive smear campaign against me because I pointed out that the old school safe withdrawal rate studies get the numbers wrong. Well, Larry, not too long ago, you know, I did this back in 2002. Larry, I don't know, a few months ago, put a post saying the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are a case of garbage in, garbage out. You know, that's a stronger statement, frankly, than I ever used about them. But it's right. It's fair. But what kills me is Larry says that. But where's the follow through? If it's true that these studies are garbage in, garbage out, and it is, it would seem to me that the thing you would want to do is, you would want to, you know, why hasn't Larry had an article written? He's written articles in newspapers. Why not get an article written telling people that they've been using retirement studies for years now that get the numbers wrong, that are going to cause millions of busted retirements? Why don't they, you know, if they now accept that the old school studies are wrong, why don't they try to get them corrected? Why don't they contact the people who have these studies on the internet and say, hey, you know, fix your calculator, fix your study? Why don't they tell John Bogle? John Bogle appears at their meetings. The Bogle heads have an annual meeting. John Bogle's there. Couldn't John Bogle, doesn't he have the influence to, like, contact the Wall Street Journal and get this written up on the front page so that all these people who have used these garbage in, garbage out studies could save their retirements? But see, they don't do it. So what Larry is doing is he's let it in at this point. He's reached a point where he can't deny that the numbers are just wildly wrong. But he also can't take action. He's frozen. This is how we can be so wrong for so long. It takes us years to accept being wrong. It doesn't happen overnight. And we learn in tiny little stages. We get little pieces of the puzzle. And if we don't learn from those little pieces of the puzzle, we don't learn the rest. We don't advance in our understanding of just how wrong we are. Another great example is Scott Burns. Scott Burns has written 3 articles promoting the new school research on safe withdrawal rates. You know, God bless him. But I had some email discussions with Scott, and Scott, in these email discussions, was getting hostile. He was borderline hostile. He at one point he says, Rob, you've added a new layer of understanding to the retirement studies, but your approach is catastrophically unproductive. What he meant by my approach is I did just what I'm saying Larry Swedrow should do. I didn't just say you need to look at valuations to get the retirement numbers right. What I said was we need to tell people. I said, why don't we do a calculator giving the accurate numbers, which I did. And Scott mentioned that, but he never linked to it. He doesn't want to go that next step. He's willing to take a little baby step. He's willing to say, well, maybe the old school studies aren't perfect, but you know, they're okay. I don't want to upset anybody. You see, humans don't like to upset other people. And when you tell people that passive investing is wrong, you're going to upset them. There's no getting around it. You know, when I was banned from these various discussion boards, the reason given me is that telling people the realities of stock investing is quote-unquote disruptive. And it is. If you're investing passively, the realities are extremely disruptive. But I mean to be disruptive. I'm trying to help people. My attitude is you're better to learn the realities from some guy who posts on a discussion board than to learn by seeing your retirement portfolio devastated. Aren't you? But see, Scott couldn't take it that far, and Larry couldn't take it that far, and all of us humans have a reluctance to take it that far. Now, am I so different? I'm not. I'm different in that I now take a strong stand, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, but that's because I've learned that from experience, how important that is. I was just like everybody else, just like Larry Swedrow, just like Scott Burns, just like John Bogle, just like all the rest. I once believed in passive investing. In the mid-90s, I had a little bit of money in stocks. It wasn't a lot of money. Maybe $20,000. And I remember one year, you know, the numbers went way up these bull years, and I was thrilled. It's like, hey, money for nothing. What's not to like? Now, I should have, looking back, I think, why didn't you get it, dummy? Why didn't you understand? Why didn't you ask yourself, where did the money come from? That's what I'm always telling people to ask. In a bull market, where do you think the money comes from? We're borrowing it from future years. Why didn't I ask myself that? Well, I didn't want to know the answer. I wanted the money. I liked the feeling of money for nothing. I didn't want to know the answer to that question. It's only because of circumstances that I was put in that I learned that passive investing does not work. And, you know, because my board communities, my internet discussion board communities were being destroyed by abusive posting, I was put in a situation where if I was going to save these boards, I had to do more research. I had to learn more. There was no other way to combat the problem. And on a retire early board, you can't exactly not talk about safe withdrawal rates. How can you tell people how to put together a retirement plan without talking about the retirement numbers? And once you know they're wrong, what are you going to do? Pretend you don't know? So it was circumstances that caused me to overcome my cognitive dissonance. It's not that I'm not human. It's certainly not that I'm smarter than all these other people. It's that I was put in circumstances where I had no choice but to overcome my cognitive dissonance. And it didn't happen a day or a week or a month or a year. It's taken me 7 years to get to where I am today. Daily work. I've worked this hard. And I can go back, and as I say, at one time I believed in passive investing. On May 13th, 2002, I put forward a post saying I thought that the old school safe withdrawal rate studies were analytically invalid, but I didn't say anything then about passive investing being insane. It never occurred to me that the fact that the safe withdrawal rate studies were wrong meant that passive investing didn't work. Now that's as plain as day. You know, now, that, to me, the logic chain is so obvious. If the only reason why they didn't count valuations in those retirement studies is that they didn't believe you had to. Passive investing says you don't have to worry about valuations. So they didn't count it. That's why. Now it's plain as day to me that the whole problem has always been passive investing. But I didn't see it for years. I started talking about this passive investing stuff. I think it might have been early 2008 when that happened. Before that, I used to talk about the old school retirement studies, not passive investing. And it sort of dawned on me over time. You know, I was posting at Bogleheads and I saw all this dogmatism and I said, what is going on here? And over time, I came to see, oh, that's what's going on. But it took years. So what I'm trying to tell you is there is no intellectual problem here. The case against passive investing is just painfully obvious. But that doesn't mean that smart people can understand it in 5 minutes. It can take years to understand the most painfully obvious point if letting in that painfully obvious point causes cognitive dissonance. And it does. In this field, it does. It causes one of the problems, and this is the great paradox of the work I do. When I started talking about the old school studies, I knew that there was going to be some abusive posting because I knew that the author of one of the studies was, you know, prone to that. But I believed I was safe because what I was talking about was a numerical calculation. And I said, ultimately, if you get a numerical calculation wrong, you've got to acknowledge it. You can't get away with not doing it in a public forum. How are you going to get away with that? It's the reality is just the opposite. If I had had a weaker case, if there had been there's never been a sliver of evidence in favor of the old school studies. There's a mountain of evidence showing that they're wrong, and there's nothing showing they're right. And that's a problem for me. The reason why it's a problem is there is no face-saving way for the authors of the old school studies to admit they were wrong. If I could come up with a face-saving way, I don't think we would have ever had this friction. But they feel like fools. If they let the idea that they're wrong enter their head, they feel like fools. Because it's so obvious that you should have included valuations. And the same thing is true with passive investing and the efficient market theory. The flaws in the efficient market theory and the flaws in the passive investing model are so painfully obvious that to acknowledge them makes you feel like a fool. And people don't like to feel like fools. If I could come up with some long, complicated argument explaining why passive investing doesn't work, you know, E equals MC squared, a blackboard full of, you know, all these equations, I think all of the passive investing advocates could acknowledge that they were wrong. They would just look at it and they'd say, E equals MC squared, I get it, Rob. Thanks, man. That's what we needed to hear. Now we all get it. But, you know, I can't do that. The case is just this obvious thing that Valuations affect long-term returns. Therefore, you obviously should take valuations into account in deciding on your stock allocation. Duh. But if they have to acknowledge that they've been wrong in the advice they've given for, 30 years because, they didn't consider that valuations affect long-term returns, they feel like idiots. I don't want them to feel like idiots, but I can't help it. I can't change the reality. They're not dumb. They feel dumb, but they're not dumb. But once they start to feel dumb, then they get defensive. And once they get defensive, they get hostile, and once they get hostile, their minds close. We have to figure out a way around this. We have to find some way of letting all the passive investing advocates off the hook so that they can start talking straight about how stock investing really works. A great example was Earn a Buck. Earn a Buck is a guy who posted at the Vanguard Diehards board. And he didn't agree with my ideas on investing, but he was pretty fierce in agreeing that, in opposing the smear campaigns. He said Rob has a right to post. So he was a stand-up guy. But one time, something he did come to me agree with me on was the safe withdrawal rate studies. And he said what I loved was this comment. He said, I used to listen in on the Motley Fool discussions. I don't think he posted, but he used to lurk. And so I know this argument going back to the beginning. And he said, I used to agree with Grainy. I used to think Grainy was right. Rob was nuts. But he said, over time, I have come to believe Rob is right. And Grainy really is going to cause millions of busted retirements because of his refusal to correct his study. But what I found fascinating about that was he didn't agree with me for a long time. It took years. And the issue is so simple. There's nothing complicated about it. But you see, the way the human mind works is we have a filter on what we let in. And, I can't tell you what the magic was that caused, that caused the click. If I could figure out what the click was, that's what I need to figure out. What caused Earn a Buck to click? But I think the trouble is that it's something different for each of us. There is no one thing that causes the click. It's a combination of life experiences. I think this price crash is causing some people to have a click experience. They're saying, wait a minute, I need to rethink. But then again, we have this problem that some of them that are having the click experience are giving up on stocks altogether rather than just giving up on passive investing. That's our danger. But just because an idea is simple doesn't mean that people are going to accept it in a week or a month or a year. So it's possible for millions to be very wrong for a very long time. That really does happen. Drip Guy is one of the fiercest of the goons. And I communicate with the goons because it baffles me. The case for rational investing is so strong, it benefits everyone. And it just baffles me. Why would there be anyone opposed to it, much less someone as viciously opposed as somebody like Drip Guy is? And so I try to figure out, what's their motivation? What's driving them? And at one point, this was a few months ago, Drip Guy he was totally exasperated with me. And he just said, Rob, we just don't think timing the market is possible. See, that's the mental block. And the problem there is it sounds too good to be true. If we could time the market, and he said this, he said, look, Rob, if we could time the market, that would be fantastic. That would be just wonderful. It would make stock investing so great, so much better than it is. But the truth is we can. We can time the market long term. You can't time it short term, but you sure can time it long term. But he can't let that in. It's another human trait. Sometimes we just can't let in good news. People are like that. I mean, have you ever seen somebody like that There's something wonderful, you know, that there's somebody that loves them and they can't let it in. They can't believe that, you know, that girl really wants him to ask her to the dance. It's like he can't let it in. He can't believe it. It's just too good. And he's squandering opportunities. And that's what we're all doing. We've got this research of the past 30 years, which presents us with a huge opportunity to achieve financial freedom early in life. And we can't let it in. Well, the last example I'll bring up is Ben Solar. Ben Solar used to post at the Motley Fool board and at the Fire board. And Ben Solar was a defender of mine. He was one of the big defenders. And but I just remember a conversation with him once where he would just say, he said, he was talking about the Bernstein, what Bernstein says about safe withdrawal rates. And Bernstein was saying the safe withdrawal rate is 2%. But if you actually read, and this is, you know, when valuations were high, and if you actually read what Bernstein says in his book, Bernstein, he did something a little funny. He did a calculation, and the calculation showed that the safe withdrawal rate was 1.5%. But then he stated it as 2. I think he was rounding up. I think Bernstein was shocked by the number, and so he rounded up. He didn't want to say 1.5. It scared him. So he said 2. But then Ben Solar pointed out, he says, look, Rob, you know, you're saying it's 2, and Bernstein says it's 2, but it can't be 2. And he says, look, if you actually look at what Bernstein says, it's really 1.5. He says, what are we going to do, believe it's 1.5? Well, my answer is yes. If that's what the calculation shows, we should say 1.5. But Ben Solar saying it can't be 1.5. It just can't be. And that's really what everyone's doing. Everyone's just saying it can't be. Now, in other words, they're shocked. When we are shocked, we don't let it in. In other words, there are certain facts we just can't let into our consciousness. They're just too shocking. And of course, what happened is passive investing made us go to sleep. We stopped paying attention to valuations. As a result, valuations went up, 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 and they went up beyond what we ever imagined possible. We went to valuation levels in the 90s never seen before in history. But most of us didn't know it. We were passive investors. We weren't paying any attention. And of course, what we were doing was bringing the long-term return on stocks to levels lower than they've ever been in history. But again, we didn't know it. We didn't pay attention. And then I came along and pointed out the numbers, and somebody like Ben Solar says it just can't be. And if Ben Solar says it can't be, and he's a defender, imagine what the goons were thinking. They're thinking it can't be times 10. And now they've had a price crash, and now they're still saying it can't be, but they're a little shaky. Anyway, the point of all this is, intuitively, you would believe that if something was as obvious as the flaws in the passive investing model, that it would be impossible for millions of smart, good people to get it so wrong for so long. But it's not impossible. It's consistent with human behavior. With what we know about human behavior, that we would not let in the shocking information, that we would not allow that cognitive dissonance would stop us from thinking through the realities, that to the extent we did let it in, we would only let in little pieces at a time, so that it will take years for us to acknowledge that passive investing is a failed model, and that we will be highly reluctant to explore the implications. So even if we let it in enough to say, oh, you know, maybe those old school studies are really a case of garbage in, garbage out, we still, even after doing that, even after stating the realities in type on a computer screen, we still won't go about the business of alerting people or getting articles in the Wall Street Journal or letting our fellow community members or building calculators. This is how humans process information. It's not that the argument against passive investing doesn't hold up. The argument against passive investing really is insane. It really is nutso. It really is preposterous, the idea that you don't need to change allocation in response to big price changes. But it is totally a human thing not to let that in for some time. My job is to sort of force people in a kind way, but to force people to look at it, because it's only by looking at it that we will develop the courage to take these further steps. And it's when we take the further steps, it's when we explore the realities and the implications of the fact that valuations affect long-term returns, that all the good stuff happens. That's when it becomes possible to develop strategies alternative to passive investing, strategies that actually stand a good chance of working in the real world. I love to hear feedback, both positive and negative. Please consider, if you have some thoughts on the podcast, clicking that Contact Rob button on the left side of each page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.